Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Typically, it's my role to interview lawyers, regulators, policymakers, and entrepreneurs in the space to talk about the legal side of crypto, what laws are being created in the space. Today, I wanted to highlight the paper published on January 29th by Rebecca Redig, Michael Moser, and Katya Gilman. Rebecca and Michael are former Law of Code guests. Paper is titled Genuine DeFi as Critical Infrastructure, a Conceptual Framework for Combating Illicit Finance Activity in Decentralized Finance. And the goal of this paper is to begin a conversation around the novel ways laws and regulation can achieve financial integrity goals in DeFi, and it sets out a conceptual framework for doing so. You know, one of the main problems with permissionless fintech is, as Jason Gottlieb posited on Twitter, as soon as anyone can use it, anyone can use it. And the industry is strongly fighting illicit finance, but there's much more that can be done. And this paper offers a great framework, particularly from the US side. But I think these concepts and the principles behind it and the arguments made can be applied across jurisdictions. So we'll start with the main issue, and the paper highlights the issue as being that traditional finance integrity laws and regulation are attached to intermediaries, and they're not amenable to intermediary-less blockchain-based software systems like decentralized finance or DeFi. So they propose, or they make three proposals. The first is proposing a definition of independent control to allow for the identification of systems dependent on centralized actors. Second, The proposal includes classifying neutral technological systems without these centralized system control persons as genuine DeFi, as critical infrastructure. So they propose classifying these systems, these neutral technological systems that don't have central or system control persons, as critical infrastructure subject to oversight by the Treasury Department's Office of Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protections. That's OCIP. Or OCCIP. The third proposal is for certain types of businesses that interact with genuine DeFi but are not system control persons, so SCPs. They propose creating a new category of critical communications transmitters, CCTs. So critical communications transmitters would be the new category, which would have regulatory obligations to aid in the protection of U.S. national and economic security, but would not be financial institutions subject to the Bank Secrecy Act, or the BSA. So that's just very high level, the three proposals that they give in the paper, and that's in the summary paper that you can find online. But I really just finished reading the full paper and made quite a few highlights and wanted to really walk through the entire paper for those of you who may have read the summary but didn't have a chance to read. I believe the full paper is around 45 pages. So let's go into the paper. This is Genuine DeFi as Critical Infrastructure, a Conceptual Framework for Combating Illicit Finance Activity in Decentralized Finance by Rebecca Redig, Michael Moser, and Katya Gilman. So the paper starts by identifying the current landscape, and particularly in the US, you have this decades-old financial integrity regime to address concerns related to anti-money laundering, countering the financing of terrorism, and sanctioning bad actors or countries that threaten the economic and national security of the US. And that is the way the traditional finance system combats illicit activity. And in this TradFi system, these intermediaries, which include banks, registered broker-dealers, money service businesses, engage in specific types of financial activity on behalf of their customers and are the ones that the government designates as needing to adhere to these AML and CFT and sanctions requirements. This reliance on intermediaries creates a huge challenge when there is an intermediary-less system like DeFi. And that's where this paper comes in. The goal of this paper, as I said before, is to begin a discussion. And they take a really interesting approach in doing so, one that is both granular and broad at the same time. So they say it is possible to address the policy goals underlying these traditional financial integrity regimes with DeFi, which is encouraging because a lot of times the big problem is this difficulty in aligning a DeFi system with a central system without that intermediary. How do you act as a gatekeeper? How do you ensure that there is, that you are at least monitoring and minimizing the illicit activity? Imposing existing laws and regulations is not the answer to achieving the underlying goals of the traditional financial integrity regimes. And they write that any regulatory proposal in that regard must regard or must acknowledge the realities of DeFi technology, which I think is so important, right? Go back to the basis, which is at its heart a communication system that allows users to transmit information about their desired economic transactions. So let's go back to that one more time. Any regulatory proposal in this regard, that is the AML, CFT, sanctions regard, must acknowledge the realities of DeFi technology. And DeFi at its heart is a communication system that allows users to transmit information about their desired economic transactions. In some instances, persons or entities maintain independent control over elements of the blockchain-based software system that allows for financial transactions. And in other systems, the technology operates neutrally and autonomously, coined as on-chain CeFi for the first one. So where some system and some intermediaries maintain independent control, where there is no independent control and it's neutral and autonomous, that is considered genuine DeFi. And they quote an article by Katrin Schuller and Sophie Klutz and Fabian Shah. So you have this distinction, right? You have the on-chain centralized finance. So the independent control exists and instances, persons, or entities maintain that control over the blockchain-based software system. And then you have the neutral and autonomous system as genuine DeFi. Policy proposals must focus on parts of a DeFi system where transactions by illicit actors can be properly documented, detected, and deterred. Now, at the same time, policymakers must not undermine the significant advantages of cryptographically secured, resilient, and widely accessible networks that can enable their own democratic and financially inclusive policy goals, such as the Treasury Department enabled humanitarian aid to 60,000 Venezuelan healthcare workers under an authoritarian government, which only succeeded because of the permissionless and non-intermediated nature of cryptocurrencies. So here's a great example of where they're saying, let's not throw the good stuff out. Let's keep the good stuff and let's create systems to minimize the things we don't want to exist. And they use the example of Circle partnering with the Bolivian Republic of Venezuela and Artem to deliver aid to Venezuelans using USDC. And this is back in November 2022. So section one of this paper, and this paper is really broken into three parts. Section one provides a brief overview of the current financial integrity regime in the United States, focusing largely on the Bank Secrecy Act, the laws and regulations relating to U.S. sanctions, and how financial institutions implement programs relating to both. Section 2 defines DeFi for the paper and discusses sources of illicit finance risk in DeFi, namely cyber risk, system management risk, and usage risk. Section 3 sets out a three-part conceptual framework for combating illicit finance risks in DeFi systems. So you have Section 1, broad overview of the regime currently. Section 2, more DeFi focused from a risk perspective. And Section 3, the conceptual framework, how we can address illicit finance in DeFi. So to go to Section 1, it briefly describes the AML and CFT regime under the BSA, which focuses on regulating financial institutions, which is an important phrase that you'll see a lot or you'll hear a lot in this paper, not providers of software services, the regulation of financial institutions, and then discusses the U.S. economic sanctions regime, which is the other key half of the U.S. legal approach to financial integrity. So there's largely, you know, three parts. There's AML, CFT, and sanctions. So the first part of this section talks on the Bank Secrecy Act and related legislation. The Bank Secrecy Act was first passed in 1970 to promote financial transparency through improved financial record keeping and responsiveness to law enforcement inquiries. So you have to think back in those days, right? Back in that time, largely before computers were used, there was so much on the books of the bank that that the regulators wouldn't have access to, law enforcement wouldn't have access to. So this was largely to promote transparency in that regard. Congress had subsequently amended the BSA first in, Congress has subsequently amended the BSA first in 1986 with the Money Laundering Control Act to criminalize money laundering and deter complicit bankers, lawyers, and accountants from participating in their clients' money laundering. Then in 1992, so first 1970, 1986, and then again in 1992 with the Annunzio Wiley Act to require financial institutions to file reports, so suspicious activity reports, or SARs for short, with FinCEN detailing certain suspicious activity that could potentially indicate money laundering or other enumerated crimes, and to implement procedures reasonably designed to maintain minimum standards for an AML program, including verification and record keeping for wire transfers and a proactive detection and reporting regime. Two more amendments were made in 94 and 98, largely relating to requiring bank regulatory agencies to develop procedures on AML examination for banks, as well as requiring the Treasury Department and other agencies to develop a national money laundering strategy. So this was more high level and more focused on the regulators themselves. Then after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, the Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism act of 2001. So that's the Patriot Act. I don't think I've ever seen it spelled out fully before. It's quite a long act, but the USA Patriot Act updated the law to reflect new technology and new threats, introducing customer due diligence requirements as well as information sharing requirements between financial institutions and the US government. It also provided additional avenues for sanctioning illicit actors. Now, in 2020, Congress passed the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020, the AMLA or AMLA, to strengthen, modernize, and streamline the existing AML regime by promoting innovation, regulatory reform, and industry engagement. Now, to enhance the BSA's existing illicit finance framework, the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 emphasized the need for risk-based AML programs and explicitly expanded the statutory scope of the BSA to include businesses that provide covered financial services involving value that substitutes for currency, whereas convertible virtual currency, including crypto, was previously only captured through FinCEN's own interpretation of its authority through rulemaking and guidance. So again, the AMLA, the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020, was the first to explicitly expand the scope of the BSA to include businesses that were involved in value in financial activity and services that included value that substitutes for currency. So that brings crypto into the ambit. Now, pursuant to the AMLA, so the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020, FinCEN issued for the first time national AML and CFT priorities that included cybercrime, including relevant cybersecurity and virtual currency considerations to guide how financial institutions should structure their risk-based AML programs to reallocate resources from other lower priority risk or practices to manage and mitigate higher priority risk, including any identified as strategic AML priorities. And that was in the Anti-Money Laundering Program Effectiveness Guidance issued in 2020. The next point they have just talks about how the BSA hinges on the regulation of financial institutions, right? This was created to govern a type of person or entity that conducts certain types of financial activity or otherwise facilitates those type of financial activities on behalf of others. The statute defines financial institutions by listing types of persons that provide services involving holding or storing funds on behalf of customers, exchanging currencies for customers, or transferring funds from one person to another on behalf of a customer, or otherwise facilitating funds, transfers, or payments for a customer. So again, that's the definition of a financial institution, these types of persons that facilitate or provide these services. Specifically, under the BSA, financial institutions include a broad array of financial intermediaries, such as banks, Securities and Exchange Commission, registered brokers or dealers, money service businesses, telegraph companies, casinos, and anyone subject to federal or state bank supervisory authority. In its 2019 guidance, application of FinCEN's regulations to certain business models involving convertible virtual currencies, so this is the 2019 FinCEN guidance, the regulator states that its regulations exempt from the definition of money transmitter those persons providing the delivery, communication, or network access services used by a money transmitter to support money transmission services. So that's an important point. They exempt from the definition of money transmitter those persons providing the delivery, communication, or network access services used by a money transmitter to support money transmission services. So not the services themselves, but those tools used to support that. And this is because the suppliers of tools, communications, hardware, or software that may be utilized in money transmission are engaged in trade and not money transmission. Now, 2019 was not the first time that FinCEN made this claim. An earlier FinCEN administrative ruling had stated that the production and distribution of software in and of itself does not constitute acceptance and transmission of value, even if the purpose of the software is to facilitate the sale of virtual currency. Once again, the production and distribution of software in and of itself does not constitute acceptance and transmission of value, even if the purpose of the software is to facilitate the sale of virtual currency. And that was from an earlier FinCEN administrative ruling from 2014 titled Application of FinCEN's Regulation to Virtual Currency Software Development and Certain Investment Activity. That builds on even earlier guidance before FinCEN ever publicly discussed cryptocurrencies, where FinCEN distinguished the provision of software and hardware services as not money transmission, even where the software and hardware services were used by others to conduct regulated transmission services. It has always been that under the BSA, persons engaged solely in software development activity are not financial institutions under the BSA, nor are the software providers who simply offer services for communication or network access, even if those services are used by financial institutions for regulated activity. And that makes sense. Just because you use a certain internet provider to conduct money transmission should not implicate that service provider. And that would have huge ramifications for the ability of a competitive market, frankly, to exist when you'd only have the biggest entities being able to afford to pay the fees that would have to be put onto them after a regime like this was set up. Now they go into sanctions laws, and this is a brief summary of U.S. sanctions laws. The U.S. government's ability to impose sanctions forms the second key part of the financial integrity regime in the United States. So first we have AML and CFT, now we have sanctions. The U.S. Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, has been delegated sanctions authority by Congress and designates certain individuals, entities, and jurisdictions to restrict the ability of specified persons to engage in business, provide services, or engage in other economic activities with them in order to protect the country's economic and national security interests and further U.S. foreign policy goals. Now, OFAC has the ability to impose, OFAC has the ability to impose, number one, primary sanctions on U.S. persons or entities or in situations where there is a connection to the U.S. And of course, every word in that sentence could be broke down. But number two, secondary sanctions, sanctions against non-U.S. persons relating to a specified activity that occurs outside the U.S. with certain sanctioned jurisdictions or entities. So you have primary ones that are more US-based and secondary ones that are largely activity-related outside the US. OFAC's powers permit the imposition of complete sanctions, prohibitions for all trade and economic activity with a particular country, as well as selective sanctions that target prohibitions against particular persons or entities. OFAC issues sanctions by adding the names of the entity to the Specially Designated Nationals, or the SDN list, which lists certain transactions on the Sectoral Sanctions Identification, or SSI list, or otherwise publishing informations. Or sorry, these are two ways they do it. So they either add the name of the entity to the SDN list, or they list certain transactions on the SSI list, or they otherwise publish information about sanctioned countries or entities. Now, they note OFAC does not have unlimited powers. They are curbed by various parts of the laws, regulations, and executive orders. They do have wide latitude, though, and broad discretion when imposing sanctions to protect the country. Now, in practice, under the BSA, the legal and regulatory standard is not zero tolerance or total elimination of the risk, even if some financial institutions articulate this aspiration, but rather the standard is reasonable control over and mitigation of risks that allocate attention to priorities while valuing the importance of giving consumers and businesses access to the financial system. And this was cited, and in making that point, they cite many speeches by acting comptroller of the currency. That was in 2005, I believe, and William Fox by the director of FinCEN in a presentation in 2004. So there's many, many points to cite that really the standard is not zero tolerance or total elimination. We don't see that. But it's reasonable control over and mitigation of risks that allocate attention to priorities while valuing the importance of giving consumers and businesses access to the financial system. As with the BSA and financial institutions, AML and CFT programs flowing therefrom, U.S. sanctions programs also require a risk-based approach, notwithstanding the strict liability standard for U.S. persons engaged in sanctions violations. The standard for sanctions compliance in practice is also not zero tolerance. For U.S. persons who may have involvement in any way, the prohibition does apply even where the person is dealing with sanctioned persons, which has been construed to include nearly any indirect benefit or service from, to, or from a designated person, regardless of it being material or substantial. So you cannot interact with people who are on the sanctions, and obviously, that largely is because it is a strict liability standard. But still, it's interesting to note that the standard is not a zero tolerance, but, and they write here that any person or entity that is a U.S. person, majority owned by a U.S. person, or conducts business in or with the United States must not engage in activity that contributes or provides funds, goods, or services by, to, or for the benefit of any sanctioned party or interests of a sanctioned party, or facilitates any of the foregoing. Now, the next section, section two, I'll skip over because if you're listening to this, chances are you're very familiar with DeFi and you don't need an overview of the technical aspects of DeFi systems, but we will touch on briefly some of the points that they make regarding DeFi and illicit finance concerns. There's a great section on defining DeFi, a really helpful graph on DeFi transaction flow. And then they get into the sources of illicit finance risks in DeFi, which emanate from different risks than in TradFi and typically come from one of three sources. There's the cyber risks within the technology of the DeFi protocols themselves, either through improper coding or improper configuration of the system. Secondly, they list out that the second risk, really, which is poor or compromising risk management practice that can create a vector for attack. And third, and the one we'll dive into the most in depth here, is from the use of a protocol for the laundering or concealment of ill-gotten funds. So in the case of cyber risk, they talk about the wormhole bridge exploit and give the example there. From system management risks, they give the example or the case study of the Ronin Bridge hack. The Ronin Bridge hack, where the Lazarus Group stole $625 million US worth of cryptocurrency, but they do explain how it was anything but a DeFi hack. And then there's the usage risk, and international regulators and policymakers have focused on the ways illicit actors can use DeFi protocols. So rather than the protocol themselves being exploited necessarily, it would be used in the manner it should be used, although that would be in the case of laundering stolen assets. So you'd be using the protocol in an illegal manner. illicit actors employ many of the same unlawful tactics in DeFi as they do in TradFi. In traditional finance, you use structurings. They'll break up transactions into smaller amounts when placing them into the system. They'll use layering, creating an obscure network of transactions so the flow of funds are difficult to follow. And there will be integration, moving funds out of DeFi to centralized exchanges or to the off-chain world. And they give an example of sort of how this happens in each case. We won't go too in-depth of that. And then they have the usage risks, and they talk about what happened after the Ronin Bridge exploit happened, and the Lazarus Group engaged in both structuring and layering to make it difficult for law enforcement to trace the funds. So that's a bit of the background on DeFi and the illicit finance risks. The final section proposes a framework for combating illicit finance risks in DeFi that's built upon both the realities of DeFi, the sources of illicit finance risks therein, as well as the principles underlying the AML, CFT, and sanctions regimes we have today. The framework that they propose addresses the three main problems recognized by regulators, policymakers, and industry. So first, and probably the biggest one, is that not all DeFi systems are not actually decentralized. Second, that existing intermediary-based regulation does not lend itself to genuine DeFi systems. And third, that sources of illicit finance risk in DeFi systems significantly differ from those in TradFi and thus require new solutions. So the framework that they outline proposes to A, define what constitutes independent control over a software system such that it could be classified as on-chain centralized finance or CeFi and thus likely subject to certain existing regulatory obligations which must happen after examining the facts and circumstances of the person exercising independent control. It also proposes to classify genuine DeFi systems as critical infrastructure in the financial sector overseen by the Treasury Department's OSIP. So that is the Treasury Department's Office of Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protection. I'll refer to it as OSIP. I'm not sure if that's the correct terminology, but it will be OSIP for the rest of this podcast. And the third proposal is to create a new category of critical communications transmitters that interact with and are integral to genuine DeFi systems, but do not meet the definition of independent control, such that they would have to undertake certain tailored obligations to protect U.S. and national and economic security without becoming financial institutions. So they will draw a line between these communication transmitters that interact in DeFi systems that don't rise to the level of being a financial institution subject to the BSA. So in the first proposal, it's identifying and defining independent control in on-chain software systems. And they discuss the idea that in certain on-chain systems, some identifiable actors have special privileges that allow them to place restrictions on user assets or otherwise have independent control over the system and thus user funds. And those are similar to many TradFi intermediaries and what they exercise over customer assets. And where identifiable actors are performing the exact same function as traditional financial intermediaries, regulation should not differ simply because of the software involved. And importantly, such regulation does not require creating a new cryptocurrency-related category of financial institution, but the better approach is to define when persons, including natural persons or entities, are engaged in the exact same activity in blockchain-based software applications as BSA-enumerated financial institutions. And this should hinge on persons administering, managing, or otherwise affecting users' assets or transactions in the DeFi context. To that end, they propose a definition of independent control that should capture on-chain centralized finance intermediaries. So their definition of independent control is that it means for a blockchain-based software system that allows for financial transactions, the unilateral ability to exercise operational authority over any third party's value in the system or otherwise immediately affect any value within the system, including by seizing operation from within the system, or to admit, permit, restrict, deny, or modify those who have access to the system, or the ways in which anyone has used or accessed the system for any reason or at any time in any way that substantially affects any third party's value in the system. So those are the two examples of unilateral control, where the software system that is blockchain-based has the unilateral ability to either exercise operational authority over any value or admit, permit, restrict, deny, or modify those access in or previously in the system. Using this definition of independent control, one that is not specified to upgrading code alone, allows the definition to remain evergreen and grow as these technological software-based systems evolve. But this guidance doesn't come from nowhere. In 2019, FinCEN guidance showed that FinCEN recognized that MSB obligations are the responsibility of those persons who are, quote, acting as intermediaries and have total independent control over the value. And there's that independent control over the value owned by customers and provided to the software or business model. But they do caution that systems control persons, so these people who exercise independent control over the system, they refer to as system control persons. They say that attachment of BSA regulatory obligations to those persons that meet the definition of system control persons should not be automatic for at least two reasons. First, given the public accessibility of on-chain data, system control persons generally do not have the siloed, unique access to risk data that traditional financial institutions have. Second, illicit finance regulation and classification of persons as financial institutions requires analysis of the facts and circumstances of business models and certain types of activity. After determining whether there is a person exercising independent control within a system, one must engage in examining the facts and circumstances of that particular system to determine whether the person merits any regulation or is subject to certain financial laws, including the BSA. By design, system control person does not include certain actors that regulators and policymakers have posited as having some form of control over DeFi systems. So these three persons that they say regulators will often posit as having some form of control are persons with significant portions of governance tokens associated with a particular DeFi protocol. They don't consider them these system control persons who can unilaterally influence or change the system, protocol. Second, on-chain governance system, frequently referred to as DAOs, that can change how DeFi protocols function, do not necessarily have independent control sufficient to be system control persons. Third, the system control person definition does not capture third-party exogenous software integrated into a DeFi protocol, most notably oracles. Now, where a user can counteract or otherwise avoid the impact of a change, there is likely no person independently controlling the funds and thus no system control person. Any legislation, they write, any legislation or guidance or regulation that imposes BSA-related obligations on system control persons must recognize both the two-part analysis set forth above. So that number one, is there a system control person? Yes, if so, what are the facts and circumstances of that person's activities, as well as the inherent differences in on-chain systems, and appropriately scope how, in which documentation, detection, and deterrence features of financial integrity programs can be carried out differently. Now, the next section talks on genuine DeFi as critical infrastructure. And I think this really is the most important part of the paper. And it's a huge question they answer. It's how to accomplish illicit finance policy objectives in genuine DeFi systems. How do you accomplish the goals that you set out and the principles that underscore these AML, CFT regimes without completely removing the benefits of a DeFi system and installing an intermediary? And they look back at history. Traditionally, communication tools and providers such as telephone, internet infrastructure companies, even the mail, when used to communicate one's intention to complete an economic transaction or in fact moving bits and bytes that represent actual value are not classified as financial institutions subject to the BSA. And they do point out in the footnote that although the definition of financial institution includes telegraph companies, the implemented regulations of the BSA also include an explicit exemption for telegraph companies from the requirement concerning the establishment of anti-money laundering programs. So important footnote there. Regulators and policymakers applying a technology-neutral approach should theoretically apply the same rules to communication tools in genuine DeFi systems. And that makes sense. They talk about the background on critical infrastructure in the US, which dates back to 1998 when President Bill Clinton issued a presidential directive and white paper underscoring the need to strengthen critical infrastructure to prevent attacks and avoid harm to the US's national and economic security. And this included certain types of interdependent and cyber-supported infrastructure that were essential to the functioning of the US economy. Now, over the last three decades, various directives and legislation has furthered this concept of critical infrastructure. Today, there's an agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, leads the national effort to understand, manage, and reduce risk of infrastructure. CISA works across government agencies to do this, to coordinate responses and establish best practices. And so when you think of genuine DeFi systems, this is technological infrastructure underpinning a new approach to conducting transactions, financial transactions specifically, and are probably best classified as critical infrastructure. Now, OKIP's role in the development and rapid dissemination of information and standards on risk and resilience across infrastructure that's critical and sufficiently connected to the financial system is exactly the type of collaborative work in an area of natural alignment between industry and government that could foster a safe and widely accessible technologically based financial system. So they're pointing to the work that's being done with OKIP and how there's this balance between public and private parties that are working together to ensure that everyone is safer and you mitigate these risks. Of course, they do include the caveat that DeFi systems might not rise to the level necessarily of being so vital that their incapacitation or destruction would have a debilitating effect on security, the economy, public health, public safety, or any combination thereof. That still remains up to debate. But of course, regardless of whether or not it meets the test now, ensuring there are certain principles, certain qualifications or gradients could help both foster this technology, but do so in a safe way. Now, specifying DeFi systems as critical infrastructure under OKIP's remit does not make a genuine DeFi system a financial institution subject to the BSA. And that's an important distinction. If it was a financial institution subject to the BSA, this AML regime and everything would apply. To the contrary, they write, OKIP does not have regulatory authority under the BSA and is not confined to working only with or regarding financial institutions. So of course, you know, they do make a good point where the oversight of OKIP is not the sole answer, just like an AML and CFT is not the sole answer to combat illicit financial activity. They also include many other areas that make up this multi-tiered approach. One point of this approach touches on the providers operating as businesses, so those that receive compensation or charge fees for services that have integrated technological services with genuine DeFi systems, and those that have become materially important for the transmission of user-initiated communications, most notably Node as a service for our PCs. Although these same communication transmitters can be hosted individually, certain of these communications flow primarily through service providers running businesses, and the paper proposes defining these purposes as CCTs and requiring them to, and once again, CCTs is a critical communications transmitter, and requiring them to implement risk management practices and procedures. And they define these critical communication transmitters, or CCTs, as a person providing a service, A, necessary to the flow of communicating users' information about a financial transaction from a system to be settled on a blockchain network, B, that transmits a material portion of such communications, and C, is offered for the person's profit or being run by the person as a business. So a critical communication transmitter would be a person providing a service necessary to the flow of communicating users' information about a financial transaction from a system to be settled on a blockchain network that also transmits a portion of such communications and is offered for the person's profit or being run as a business. It's not intended, this definition, to capture persons who solely develop open source downloadable software, such as creators of self-hosted wallets. And they point that these CCTs are appropriate touchpoints for illicit finance risk controls because they're positioning in the DeFi transaction flow as gatekeepers to moving communications about a transaction down the flow to a blockchain network would allow them, with reasonable illicit finance risk mitigation controls, to detect, document, and deter illicit actors from finalizing transactions on a blockchain network. They mention how CCTs are implementing geo-blocking today, but then they talk about how a financial integrity program could work. It could include a requirement that CCTs implement wallet risk scoring and blocking along with auto report generation. So this could be you using API. You could screen for wallets with a risk score above a certain number as determined by the CCT's risk landscape and tolerance. And potentially block transactions involving certain wallets that hit a certain score. And so based on how CCTs operate today, they say any of these reports should contain certain limited information, date, time, transaction hash, and wallet address. This would relate to the actual transaction itself. It would not and could not and should not provide information typically found in SARs. Accordingly, any documentation requirements should not go above and beyond the reasonable, useful information relating to the actual communication of the transaction. That includes the wallet address, transaction hash, and receiving address. Of course, this auto generation would enhance law enforcement's activity and ability to detect, track, and trace bad actors in a much more immediate and robust way, while also giving the ability to block transactions that are deemed. And they end this point by saying CCTs should not be categorized as financial institutions under the BSA because they do not perform the same or even similar functions to BSA-defined financial institutions. CCTs have never any independent control over a user's cryptocurrency, never accept value, and never transmit value funds or cryptocurrency. They simply provide tools and communication systems. Okay, sure. So this is all great, but how does this CCT regulation come into place? And they make the point that existing regulations do not provide authority to the Treasury Department to create risk-based programs for non-financial institutions. But they do, however, contain the foundations upon which new legislation and additional regulation may be built. These existing laws do contemplate the need for risk-based programs for other participants in financial networks. And the authors believe that new, novel legislation may be required to create financial integrity programs narrowly tailored to this new, novel system. After implementation of legislation conferring authority to FinCEN to regulate CCTs, so we'll need some legislation that confers authority to FinCEN to regulate these actors, these systems. FinCEN, OCCIP, and CISA could further explore their authorities to determine the viability via public notice and comment rulemaking, an important theme here, of proposing expectations for persons critical to protecting U.S. economic and national security, particularly as it relates to critical infrastructure overseen by OCIP. FinCEN, working with OCIP, could develop standards for CCTs to create and maintain narrowly tailored financial integrity risk management programs. Regulation should set substantial thresholds for what constitutes a material portions of transactions or communications, since the proposal seeks to address critical functions. Not every communications provider will be critical, and thus may not need to assume the same risk-based programs contemplated herein, just as highways may have periodic way stations for certain major tractor trailers, but do not checkpoint every city intersection to check vehicle weight and identification, even if doing so may prevent additional harm. Any regulation of CCTs should follow the well-worn crawl, walk, run approach, which prioritizes a principled and highly coordinated global consensus-driven foundation that minimizes divergences and asymmetries across jurisdictions and allows for continued innovation to keep open the opportunities presented by various technologies. The whole goal with this paper, and really to push things in the right direction, is this statement. It's, let's find some core non-controversial principles in common and collaboratively determining best practices to support them via a meaningful notice and comment process, which should be achievable. So given the novelty of such a difficult problem in such a novel and new area, this is a difficult, thorny question. I think this paper did such a great job grappling with what it could look like in reality to get to the point where the discussions are underway and things are moving forward. And they write in conclusion that they believe discussion, debate, and further development through collaboration between government and industry is necessary. And they welcome input from technical experts across the industry, as well as government, who may recognize collateral impacts or technical rather than regulatory solutions that may complement this proposal. And they end with this: in the urgency to stop illicit activity, we must not forget the important and fundamental goal to empower good activity that anchors the Treasury Department's explicit mandate as, quote, the executive agency responsible for promoting economic prosperity and ensuring the financial security of the United States. Now, that was an excellent paper, as I mentioned before, by Rebecca, Michael, and Katya. And I hope you found that helpful. I think I really just wanted to share this, and I walked through it myself and wanted to reread it. So hope you enjoyed that. If there's other papers that you think audio guides would be helpful for, let me know. I think this is a good idea. Everyone always says to me, you know, the reading list is so big, but I don't know about the listening list. So we'll see if we can add to that over the next couple weeks and months. Once again, everyone, thank you for listening to this episode of Law of Code, and we'll see you soon.